Today's episode is the third and final of a three-part series looking at what life might be like on colonies or colonial spaceships. Today we are focusing on interstellar colonies, or more accurately, early interstellar colonies. As we've noted before, with the barrier of light-speed communication, in many ways a colony around another star is almost an alien civilization, as we can expect them to diverge from us quite quickly as these things go. This is something we discussed before in the episode on the Kardashev scale. Cultures diverge pretty quickly in isolation, and when you toss in options for genetic engineering and cybernetics, you could get major physical and physiological divergences quite quickly. So that is why our focus today is on early extrasolar colonies. What the ones relatively near Earth would be like early on, not what some colony halfway across the galaxy might be like by the time we get their message saying they arrived safely 50,000 years after they sent it, and maybe 500,000 years since they left, possibly hopping from planet to planet, settling each in a long chain from Earth all the way out to the edge of the galaxy. As you might recall from last episode, I introduced the idea of a Gardiner ship, a vessel that did just that, leaving Earth and stopping at stars to drop off most of its passengers and equipment, and remaining for a few years to help them get set up and to bring on new fuel and raw materials. Once they left, they would repopulate their numbers on the long journey and manufacture new colonial equipment in their many decades of spaceflight to the next system. We named our example ship Unity, after the colony ship from one of my favorite games about colonizing alien planets, Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri. When we left off in Episode 2, Unity had just arrived at our target system of Tau Ceti. Now, Unity was a big ship, 500 meters wide and 2,000 long, massing over 100 million tons, and able to travel at 10% of light speed. It is a huge ship that when it left Earth had 200,000 souls on board, and arrived 120 years later with 300,000. We will also assume they have a couple dozen smaller interplanetary colonial ships like we discussed last time, the Hyperion, except in that example Hyperion was intentionally made very slow for what a fusion craft should be capable of so we could analyze a longer voyage. We will assume fusion reactors are still pretty big and massive things not suited for landing in atmospheres, let alone leaving them, so we will say that they have larger fusion-powered freighters meant for space alone and more aerodynamic shuttles meant for landing on planets, using some chemical fuel like now, probably hydrogen and oxygen, so they can get back off a planet too, but not with much cargo. Shuttles and freighters. I will also assume someone has figured out a material cheap enough to mass produce and strong enough to serve as a space elevator on an Earth mass planet, so that we can use one on Aurora. Not a huge stretch. As we discussed before, there are materials that will do that job for any object decently less massive than Earth, and it is possible graphene, the miraculously strong carbon allotrope, could get the job done on Earth. If not, we would have to fall back on some other launch assist methods we discussed before, but I don't think it is too huge of a stretch to assume these technologies for our discussion today, just so long as we keep in mind they are all lower technology approaches to fall back on if we do not have these. Okay, let us walk through the mechanics of this colonization with those assumptions. We picked Tau Ceti as the system for our hypothetical example for a few reasons. At 12 light-years from Earth, it is the closest G-type star that is not a binary or multiple star system. As a G8 star, it is dimmer and smaller than our own sun, a G2, making it only about half as bright as our own sun. It is also older than our sun by a billion years and change, but that's okay, since it is smaller, it will live a few billion years longer anyway. It has long been a popular place in science fiction for those reasons. Tons of authors have used it as a setting, including my namesake Isaac Asimov, who used it as the home system for the planet Aurora, the most powerful of the 50 spacer worlds in his classic robot series. It has always been considered a great candidate for planets too, which we know it has, now that our telescopes are good enough to see them, and it has lots of them. We have only found 5 so far, but they are all either quite big or quite close to their sun. It's always easier to see the ones that are bigger or closer to their sun, so we were on pretty safe ground to assume there's plenty more. It also has a huge debris disk, estimated to contain 10 times the asteroids and comets our solar system has. So even if it doesn't have a good Earth analog, we have doubtless got tons of moons and asteroids to work with. As we saw in Episode 1, and discussed many times before, moons and asteroids are in many ways easier to colonize, especially if we have fusion as a power source, which we do today. So we don't need to worry about if any of those planets are of a good size and distance for classic terraforming. Truth be told, odds are good that by the time we get around to doing interstellar colonization, a very large part of humanity, possibly a supermajority, will have been born and raised inside cylinder habitats inside asteroids. So many might not only be indifferent to whether there is an Earth-like planet in a system they could terraform, but quite uncomfortable at the notion of living on one. Still, we wouldn't be thorough if we bypass this option, so we will assume a fair amount of the colonists came on this trip because they wanted an Earth-like planet to settle now that Earth is fairly full. Probably most of the folks who went on ice for the voyage. Since we are not actually talking about Tau Ceti so much as a random solar system, we will assume there is a decently Earth-like habitable zone planet there so we can discuss that option, and I will go ahead and call it Aurora. I will also assume it has got some sort of gas giant decently far from its sun, a safe enough bet. Unity, here to help us set up and also needing to pick up new raw materials and fuel, is not suited for landing on Aurora, at least not if we want it to take off again. We might be able to land it in one piece. This means our first stop is not Aurora. That's a major point worth clarifying. We always think of the first stop in a new solar system being the planet we plan to terraform, but from a practical perspective, it is the last place you want to stop. Gravity is not your friend. The hardest part about creating a large industrial infrastructure in our own solar system is getting the equipment and manpower off Earth to begin with. When arriving in a new solar system, you want to get that basic space infrastructure in place before landing on that planet. This is even more true in our case, since Unity is not going to land on Aurora. It is also going to leave the Tau Ceti system in a few years. It needs fuel and raw materials for that trip, and it also needs them to maneuver around the solar system helping with colonization. It needs fuel, hydrogen or deuterium, and that is going to be abundant anywhere in the outer solar system where methane and water ice will contain plenty of hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Even as huge as Unity is, it could retank all its fuel, water, and air off even a modest comet or icy moon, probably hundreds of times over. Gravity is not your friend if you are a spaceship, so we would probably be looking for a decent-sized icy body as close in toward the sun as we could find. That is going to be our true alpha base, because Unity is going to go right up to the thing and just park on it for a while. So Unity spots a large number of moons around that gas giant. Three of interest being a moon with its own thick nitrogen atmosphere like Titan has, one a smaller icy moon, and another smaller rocky one that shows signs of being heavy in metals and carbon. They also notice the gas giant has one giant eye-shaped perpetual storm, a bit like Jupiter's Great Red Spot, and decide for thematic purposes to name the gas giant Odin, as a mythological parallel to Jupiter, and Odin had only one eye. Having done so, they name the rocky moon Thor, the Titan-like planet with its atmosphere Njord for the Norse god of wind, and our icy moon Hodor for the Norse god of winter, not the Game of Thrones character, though I am going to pronounce it that way anyway because I love that character. Incidentally, I'm naming these things and getting a bit specific because we are planning to discuss administration and governance this time, and that is going to be easier if we try to use some examples. So Unity is going to head into Hodor and make it the first place it lands. Now Njord is the only one of these moons that Unity couldn't land and take off from, so they go ahead and find a nice large crater on Hodor and land just inside the rim. Odin is probably hitting them with a fair amount of radiation, and Tau Ceti probably has a lot more debris wandering around risking collision damage. Unity is quite heavily armored, but the colony here won't be initially, so they will be setting up around the rim and probably building things better resembling igloos than domes. Now that they have water, they have energy to spare, since removing hydrogen from water, or even deuterium, costs a tiny fraction of the energy it will produce when used in a fusion reactor. Since they do have fusion, they don't care about the distant and dim sun as a source of power. The colony here does not need sunlight. Also, Hodor isn't a big moon. We didn't want a big moon with lots of gravity, so the colonists will be living inside spin gravity habitats anyway, and won't consider the surface to be up in the normal sense. Those buildings on the surface will possess just enough gravity to make things fall down, and will exist just to handle operations on the surface, which will mostly be loading and unloading freighters. It is very easy to dig deep because it is all ice, plus some rocky meteors mixed in. They can just melt tunnels, though more likely they cut blocks of ice out and move them. A meter-wide cube of ice might weigh 1 ton on Earth, but here, a person could carry one on each shoulder like they were just big cushions. You could also make large ice domes by just having a thin dome frame, with another a bit above, and filling the interior with water, then letting it freeze and removing your frame to use elsewhere. Unity had a giant power plant, as mentioned last time, so they could be melting megatons of water and have huge hoses snaking to hundreds of those domes if they wanted, each meant to be meters thick of ice, sturdy enough to act as bomb shelters, because gravity is so low that all those meters of ice don't require any structural support. Later on, they will probably want to include a ceiling with thick insulation, so they can heat those domes without melting them, but for now, they will do. They are basically just making warehouses for the moment. So everyone is popping champagne corks, of course, probably on 120-year-old bottles brought from Earth. As mentioned last time, of the original 200,000 colonists, half stayed awake and half went on ice. Those that stayed awake are still alive. Again, as mentioned last time, the simple ability to restore life to people who have been frozen for a century also strongly implies technology to extend human lifetimes indefinitely. During the voyage, those original 100,000 gave birth to another 100,000 people, though many are probably their grandkids or great-grandkids too. Assuming half a liter of champagne each, incidentally, means they stored and drank roughly 150 tons of champagne. Everyone is happy and excited and ready to get to work, of course. Here on Hodor, they are setting up a couple of fusion reactors to power the colony and melt ice and use electrolysis to separate the hydrogen and oxygen for those reactors and for Unity. Unity is not staying long, probably just a few weeks to offload cargo, restock its tanks with fuel, water, and oxygen, and give everyone a chance to get off the ship, stretch their legs, and look around. They will then go ahead and leave Hodor, leaving behind all their freighters. Those will follow along with more water and oxygen and fuel in a week or so when they are full. The colonists on Hodor have the easiest job of the three moons, so they are also expected to do most of the food growth for Odin. They have tons of hydroponics equipment on Unity, which won't need most of it anymore since most of its passengers are disembarking in the coming months. The big construction task is going to be setting up tons of hydroponics. However, they do not have a lot of nitrogen locally or minerals, and the former is going to come from Njord. It has that big thick nitrogen atmosphere, but it also has a gravity well that is a bit much for the freighters. So before we go there, we will be looking into getting minerals needed for plant nutrients and construction. So they head over to Thor, which is a rocky, airless moon with even less gravity than Hodor. Here they are going to have to spend more time, digging in and getting smelters and refineries running. While they are digging, they are going to take some of the rock on board to process into metal, and test their ability to make tethers for space elevators. Njord will need one, though even modern-day materials will do for that. Still, we said we have better materials, and we will act accordingly. Once again, they landed in a crater, and they began digging into the floor and rim again, and assembling cylinder habitats inside. But not as many, because it's mostly just meant for living room. There will be hydroponics, which may be expanded to full self-sufficiency later, but for now they are just going to have enough of that for water and air recycling, and some fresh produce. They are also going to do something a bit weird. Onlookers who weren't paying much attention to the mission briefings will notice two larger rocky outcroppings are having cylinders built right into them, which seems a bit of a strange activity. They are a bit surprised when the freighters from Hodor arrive with their first shipment a month later, and Unity lifts off and rips both of those outcroppings free and drags them along into space. Unity has plenty of fuel now, and can easily drag an equal mass of rock around these moons. When they get to Njord, our bigger moon with a nitrogen atmosphere, one of those big outcroppings gets positioned at stationary orbit, and a space elevator goes down with an end attached to the shuttle that goes to land on the surface below. Now cargo can come back up that way and go down too. Space elevators require counterweights, and big thick ones meant for lots of cargo require larger ones plus a port facility, so we just brought one along to serve as a counterweight and orbital hub. Once more, Unity remains for a while to get things in place and to unload cargo and take on a lot of nitrogen. Those freighters have probably gone back and forth between Hodor and Thor a few times by now, and will start a circuit back and forth between those two moons and the orbital dock on Njord. We have now completed a genuine, self-sufficient interstellar colony. They don't really need much trade between them either after the first few rounds, so they really only need two freighters, one is a spare, and they could just meander around on the same circuit, one following the route backwards. In fact, those two alone probably have far more cargo capacity than would be necessary for centuries to come, since they could carry at least a ton of cargo each trip for every single citizen at their destination. But the real goal is to colonize Aurora, our Earth-like planet, so we will head there next. First though, we are going to drop off a lot of the folks currently planning to leave with Unity. We will have to return to pick up fuel and raw materials for the ship before it leaves, and about half of the folks will remain behind to help with setup and production. Most of those will ride back to Hodor and Thor on the freighters. We don't particularly need those for Aurora, which seems to have a decent amount of nitrogen in its own atmosphere and oceans. Now, we did an entire episode on terraforming, and terraforming a planet that is about the mass and temperature of Earth is not too hard. We are going to arrive in orbit with our remaining orbital hub and deploy it. However, this time we will be doing an extra trick. Back in the Space Elevators episode, I pointed out that you can have more than one tether running up to the same hub, but with their bases on the ground far apart, sort of like guy wires on a radio mast. So long as at least one of those tethers is in the north and south hemisphere each, we can keep the hub in equilibrium, and can put our tethers wherever we like, not just on the equator. This will allow us to cheaply unload to multiple sites, and also give us a handy means of traveling back and forth between locations. In fact, the tethers can meet up before the orbital hub at a lower hub to make surface-to-surface transport easier. There will be a non-stop flow of goods coming down from Unity, in large part to test its ability to manufacture tons of goods. The ship wasn't originally meant to be a perpetual mobile factory, so while it all works on paper, they want to test it. Virtually all of those goods, in terms of raw mass, will be glass and struts for domes. Those won't be actual glass, but something more like transparent metal. We have stuff these days that we can make like that, so presumably they will have something better, or gotten the process down better. Now, I have often pointed out the flaw of the idea of living under glass domes on Mars or the Moon, so it might seem peculiar that I'm suggesting it now, but Aurora already has a decently thick atmosphere that burns up meteors, so it works here. Aurora doesn't have the right atmosphere mix. It is terribly unlikely any would which didn't already have life on them. But we will assume the right stuff is there, just not in the right mix or density. It wouldn't matter much if the pressure was too high or too low, just so long as it is thick enough to burn up meteors, and not so thick sunlight can't get through, or the pressure is so high the domes would need to be as sturdy as a submarine. The funny thing is that we don't just need the domes overhead, but floors underneath. We cannot just assume the native rock will be right for Earth life, not right away. You could have fair amounts of heavy metals and radioactive isotopes in the top layer of regolith. So you will probably be using tons of vats of algae that you have crushed up local rock into to build up your more Earth-like topsoil. That will be a long, long process. It won't be done when Unity gets to its next system, nor likely totally complete when it gets to its 10th stop. We have people on this colony that were probably not young when they left Earth and spent 120 years coming out here. But they will have to live at least as long before Aurora is a place that you can walk around on outside a dome without a breathing mask and possibly a pressure suit. It's not just the land and air either. Those oceans probably don't have the right salt content, and it will take a long time before it can support a full marine ecosystem. That process itself is not our main focus today. Again, we discussed it in the terraforming episode, but today it is a backdrop for the culture here. The folks back around Odin will need years to create the sort of nice cylinder habitats they will be living in, maybe even decades, but their task of making gardens in a bottle is 1,000 times easier and faster than terraforming a planet. What we have here in this system is 3 different civilizations already. One is set on making a new Earth down on Aurora, a task of centuries before it is achieved. One is set on replicating the huge swarms of small asteroid habitats that were springing up everywhere around our own solar system when they left. A task for generations too, but with each new one completed within a generation, each created piecemeal, not a whole planet done at once. The third has an eternal task. Unity will leave this place behind soon on what amounts to a near-eternal mission, working for 1 century at a time en route to their destination before leaving most of their people behind in a new system and repeating the task. Cultures adapt to their priorities and generally tend to enshrine them. So let's add to the mix. Unity spends a couple years in orbit of Aurora and leaves it with a population of 200,000 as originally planned. When it gets back to Odin, those moons and the ship have a combined population of 100,000. Probably a little more, as people have been getting married and having kids the last few years since they arrived in system. Now, those moons had a specific trio of tasks with their own benchmarks, ones they were probably a bit overprepared for, since you tend to be conservative and cautious when drawing up plans for something that's never been done before, and is life and death, and 100 years from humanity's homeworld. Their first task was for setting themselves up as a mostly self-sufficient group. Their second was tied to that, getting the space infrastructure in place in the Tau Ceti system. The third was getting Unity all the raw materials and fuel it needed. They have also been receiving updates in technology from Earth this whole time, so besides their benchmarks for success being on the easy side of what they could have done originally, they also have 1 century of new technology and strategy for colonizing moons and asteroids. Plus, they have way more people than they originally expected to, so they are beyond ahead of schedule. Part of their surplus time and energy is going into relaxing and making their homes a bit more luxurious, of course. Part was getting even more supplies for Unity than was originally planned. They are going to go ahead and do some expansion and improvements on the ship. But they also have folks looking around at all of Odin's other moons and its own collection of Trojan asteroids, and all those extra freighters, and thinking some expansion of their own is a good idea. All the equipment they are producing is exactly what they need to settle those, and the freighters are not doing much. We haven't talked too much about individual family homes, but as I noted back in episode 1, a lot of smaller asteroids would work for that. The cylinder on board Hyperion we discussed last episode, if it was just a single level with dirt and grass on it, makes for a fairly nice house with a lawn of about 1 hectare or 2 acres. It is not an arduous task to make such a cylinder either. In a fusion economy, even ignoring the automation you probably have, you can spew out tons of metal plating for pennies on the dollar, especially aluminum, which is costly because of the energy demands of making it, and is a nice lightweight building material that won't rust. So all over these original 3 moons, you probably have a ton of small cylinders going in that are just the equivalent of housing developments or even individual homes, probably manufactured in a big complex and taken to the site. It is very easy to move large and heavy things on an airless moon with very little gravity. Not all of those are going in on those 3 moons. So when Unity arrives for resupply, they find out that a couple dozen of Odin's moons have settlements on them now. They also found out that a lot of folks who planned to come with them have since changed their minds, while others have decided they don't like the idea of living on these moons or Aurora and sign on board for Unity's second mission. Lots of people change around their place while Unity is docked for a few months retrofitting. Some come back from Aurora to live around Odin or on Unity. Some go off to those other moons and Trojan asteroids. Some leave Unity. And finally the captain says that's enough. They are leaving in a week and come tomorrow you are where you are. We also have a lot of folks thinking about their original charter, drawn up almost 130 years ago back on Earth. The situation has changed a lot since then, and is going to change a lot more. Back in the planning phase, they only planned on a small, initial space infrastructure. Now they have a fairly large one. They also have over 1 century of technological updates from home. So how should they govern themselves? Folks around Odin make up 20% of their population, not a few percent as originally planned. Some on Odin are thinking they should be their own separate state. Back on the ship, they just held popular elections. There were no real districts. Now they have districts. Each of those three moons around Odin, and each of the three landing sites. On top of that, people are spreading out from the landing sites and to other moons and asteroids. For those big six, if they do districts, should they elect their representatives to the system government at large by proportional allocation, or one representative per district elected by a majority? Ideologies will mutate too. Many will want to take that new technology and embrace an even faster rate of terraforming, while others will say stick to the original timeline and use that new tech to increase the standard of living. Others will suggest the good idea is to keep to both the original timeline and standard of living and devote resources to having and raising more children. On top of that, Tau Ceti is an old system, older than Earth, so even though the planet initially appeared lifeless, they might find some very basic life deep down in the oceans. How would that alter their plans? Others might want to use that new technology to make life forms which can survive in the existing environment, and over time people might object to replacing that new life with old Earth life. It is entirely possible that the ship Unity would barely have left the system before the colony's Unity begins to depart. Even inside the template of democracy, there are dozens of major variations and options and thousands of iterations. And as their population grows and their communities become more divergent and distinct, it is very unlikely everyone will want to govern themselves the same way, even if they maintain some loose system-wide government. The next century is bound to see a lot of changes to their colony. I imagine news of these changes would catch up to our ship Unity and be a major source of conversation on board. How to do it better next time? What to iron out in advance? I also find the notion of what sort of culture might develop on board those Gardener ships as interesting as the colonies. As they plod their way out across the galaxy for thousands of years, just settling place after place like it was a holy duty, which it might well become to them. That is assuming they don't just stop at some point and ask, "Hey, who is actually paying us to do this?" Which also raises the interesting question of what sort of currency they use back on the colony and what they use on the ship itself. On the ship, the only external thing of value is information from back home and from their daughter colonies they've been seeding behind them. Technology, culture, and entertainment. They can only be paid to continue their mission in that coin, but it is a pretty cheap one to pay people in, though very valuable to them. On board the ship, the situation is a bit different. At each stop, they refuel, but then have a set amount of raw material and energy to get to the next place, which has to be rationed. You could get some very interesting cultures and economies on board those, potentially an ever-changing one. But since they also stop every century to leave most of their people behind, they also have a pressure vent to remove those people least content with life on the ship. So some good food for thought there, I hope. We still have never really answered the question of what life in a colony would be like, but I think we did reach our goal of not just explaining some of the mechanics of colonization, but putting a more human face on it, seeing some of the non-technical challenges. To do much more than that, we would have to go the route of fiction, where we can not only set our specific technologies available, but follow along with some characters we can get to know and empathize with. There are a lot of great books on that score too, especially on the human front. I can recommend a few. The Mars Trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson, The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury, Speaker for the Dead and Ender in Exile by Orson Scott Card, and Ben Bova's Grand Tour series. Next week, we will return to the Fermi Paradox series to discuss the idea of stay-at-home civilizations, the idea that some alien civilizations might never leave their home planet, in contrast to our topic for today. We will explore the idea that we might never leave Earth, and why that might be. If you want alerts when that and other videos come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to hit the like button, share it with others, and try out some of the other episodes on the channel. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great day.